is a joint work with Aristides Katavolos. It was all motivated by a theorem of Baruch Salal's. So I'd like to start there. Basically, what we saw is that I think you all know if you're dealing with massive bimodule maps over little l infinity, then that's really the same as the theory of Schur multipliers. And in the case where things were sure multipliers, it was much easier to see why some things were true. And so what we wanted to do was find a theory that sort of generalized the idea of sure multipliers to more general massive bimodule maps, particular to the continuous case. And so that's what we've succeeded in at least partially doing. And this allows us to take some theorems that are very, very obvious in the discrete case and carry them over to the continuous case. So let me start off by reminding you about massive bimodules. So I'll always be dealing with the case where H is a separable Hilbert space, and I'll have some D contained in D of H, which is a massa. And I'll use, just to keep the amount of notation as small as possible, I'll use B of D to denote all the maps from B of H to B of H, which are bounded and are bimodule maps over D. So B of D1x D2 is equal to D1 B of x D2. And I'll use NBD to denote the set of phi B of D, which are weak star continuous or normal. Of course, there's a weak star topology on B of H, and the things which are continuous as maps from the weak star topology to the weak star topology. So let me start then with a Salal's theorem. So what Salal proved is if you have a normal bimodule map, which is a projection, so p squared equals p, and contractive. In a moment, I'll mention the fact that the CB norm and the norm are the same here, so this doesn't really make any difference. And if you look at the range of this, then the range is what we now call a ternary ring of operators. Now, this is a was very striking to me. It's a fairly well-known theorem that any time you have a completely bounded idempotent on B of H, and if you look at the range, then the range is what we call an abstract TRO, which means that there's a completely isometric representation of it on another Hilbert space someplace, so that under that representation, it satisfies this. Or in other words, if you like, there's a new product you can define on it that satisfies this triple product rule. But what Salal's theorem says that's remarkable is that in the original given product, it's already a TRO. So you don't have to represent it on some other space. It already happens. And of course, Salal also asked at that time, what happens if you drop the normal? What happens in the non-weak star continuous case? So as I said, Aristides had shown me this result, and we were trying to understand why it was true. And in the discrete case, we came up with a simpler argument. So first let me discuss what's the difference between the discrete case of these bimodule maps and the ordinary case. Let me just review a little bit facts about bimodule maps. So first, let's do the discrete case. So this is where H is little l2, and the massa is little l infinity, which I just think of as the diagonal matrices acting on little l2. Then it's pretty well known that it's pretty easy to check that if you have phi a bounded L infinity bimodule map, if you just look at what phi does to the matrix units, it has to send a matrix unit back to itself. And because of that, what phi of any matrix Xij is it just has to be Aij times Xij. So this is what we call a sure product map. So every bimodule map is just given by sure product, where sure product is this product, what some people call the freshman product of matrices, although at our university it's the sophomore product. Okay. So because each map has this sure product structure, so they're all sure product maps. It turns out that they're all automatically weak star continuous. You can just check it using the structure. Also, it's pretty clear what would happen if you compose two things. If C was sure product by A and psi was sure product by B, then the composition would be just sure product by A times B. But this product is clearly commutative. So you have that compositions, this is an abelian algebra. So in other words, B of L infinity is abelian. Let's see. Is there anything else I wanted to mention? Right. Right. But you also know exactly which ones are bounded. That's the sure multiplier theorem. If you're given A, S sub A is bounded if and only if there exists vectors xi and yj in a Hilbert space, so that the sup of the product of the norms is a finite number. The matrix entries are the inner products. So bounded sure product maps are exactly the ones which come from these kinds of vectors. I'll get that all the way up. So this is what makes dealing with little L infinity bimodule maps very simple. You have this this matrix A that you're doing sure product against. And that gives it makes it fairly easy to write things down. One other thing I should have mentioned over here is that this is independent of whether you're what kind of massa you have. But for all phi in B sub D, the norm of phi is the same as the CB norm of phi. This is an old fact first proved by Hagrup, maybe by Smith in this generality. Okay. So now let me compare this discrete case to what happens in the continuous case.
So
if you look at the continuous case, and for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to restrict attention to just one continuous case, namely where I look at L2 of 0, 1
with Lebesgue measure,
and the massa is multiplication by the L infinity function on 0, 1.
And so here, if you look at the bounded bimodule maps,
first off, they're not all weak star continuous.
In fact, the standard example of one that's not weak star continuous
is if you look at any projection P, which goes from B of L2 onto the massa itself, is not weak star continuous.
Also, unlike the discrete case, there's more than one projection onto the item, onto the diagonal. There's not a unique projection onto the diagonal. It's a bimodule map. So the things in here which are not normal are singular. In fact, there's a decomposition. The bounded maps decompose as a vector space, as a direct sum between the normal ones and what are called the singular ones. What's the third thing I wanted to mention here? The third thing is that the normal ones, just like in the other case, form an abelian subalgebra, but the singular ones is not abelian. Fact is that the singular ones are actually an ideal in the space of all bimodule maps. The fifth thing is the only thing that's a little bit hard. This is due to Wittstock. And it is that, so you know this is a non-abelian Banach algebra. It turns out that the center of this Banach algebra is exactly the normal one. So something is in the center if and only if it's weak star continuous for this Banach algebra. That's a pretty result. And then one tiny little fact that maybe hasn't been noticed before. If you take if you look at the commutator ideal, and of course by this I mean the norm closed linear span of commutators, that's contained in the singulars, but it's not equal to the singulars. So in fact, if you look at a projection onto the diagonal, that's something in here that can't be expressed as a sum of commutators. So there's stuff that I want to return to this later in the talk, but the main thing is that there's stuff in between. So what I'd like to do is next is show you this sort of elementary proof of Solel's theorem in the special case where you're dealing with the discrete case, the little L infinity, so that everything in sight is a sure multiplier, and you know exactly what's going on, okay? So first off, the thing to see is if you have a sure multiplier that's a projection, in order for phi composed with phi to be equal to phi, that means that A sure product A will have to be equal to A. That's the same thing as each Aij squared equals Aij, so Aij has to be 1 or 0. So the things that are projections correspond to, if you think of the matrix as a function of two variables, it corresponds to the characteristic functions of some subsets of n cross n. Okay? Exactly which subsets is not very well understood. But if it is a projection, it really corresponds to a characteristic function of some set. So what I'd like to do is show you how to see this allel in the discrete case. And this uses this 3 out of 4 idea that came in Aristides' talk. So let's suppose I have a subset E contained in a product space. I'll say it has the 3 of 4 property. Pictorially, if I take an x1 and an x2 and a y1 and a y2, that gives me 4 possible points in the product space. If any time 3 of those points are in E, then all 4 are in E. Okay. So if for all x1 not equal to x2, y1 not equal to y2, if 3 of xi, yj are in E, then all 4 are in E. And then the key lemma is just a little combinatorial. Let's suppose I have a set E in a product space, and E has the 3 of 4 property if and only if there exists X sub T, a disjoint family of subsets of X, Y sub T, disjoint family of subsets of Y, same indexing set, such that E is the union of these rectangles. So any set with a 3 of 4 property, it's just a little combinatorics to see it has to look like that. The second lemma, it's just a basic little computation. Suppose I look at this little 2x2 matrix A, which I think of as a sure multiplier from M2 to M2. Then its norm, well, its norm is something, so even if I get the number wrong, the theorem's still okay. It's that. It's a calculus problem. So here's a... here's what the theorem is that we can prove. So let's let P be a bounded L infinity bimodule map. So it's a sure product against some A. I suppose that P is idempotent, P squared equals P. This means that A is really the characteristic function of some set E, where E is in n cross n. And assume that the norm of P is less than 2 over square root 3. then the following things are true. The first one is there exists countable families, IN and JN, disjoint subsets of N. So by that I mean these are disjoint and these are disjoint, but I don't mean that any disjoints there, such that E is the union of IN cross JN. From this, the range of P is the sum of multiplication by the, projection by the characteristic function I sub N, B of L2, projection by the characteristic function of J sub N. So in other words, it's this sort of block diagonal thing where so each one of these gives you a rectangular block, and the fact that these are disjoint means that the rectangular blocks drift down. They don't you can't have one rectangular block below or beside another one. They have to be off set. So that's the first thing. Where'd my theorem go? So this is, I'm going to call this M. So M has to look like that. The second thing is M star M is contained in M. This is Salel's thing. And the third is that the norm of P is actually equal to 1. So let me give you the proof. It's basically one line. The fact that the norm of P is strictly less than 2/3 implies that E has this 3 of 4 property, and that means E looks like what we think. Because N's countable, everything else has to be countable. And then once you know what E is, you know what the sure product map is, and that describes this set M. And then once you know that M has this block diagonal property, you just look at you can check this property by just looking at what happens for any matrix unit in M. And you just, again, the fact that this happens for matrix units is exactly the 3 out of 4 property all over again. So the 3 out of 4 property shows up twice, once to give you this, and then once when you want to check this relation. Okay. But now that you know what P is like, you can check that this projection has norm 1, and that's the end of the theorem. So it really becomes pretty elementary, given the sure multiplier formalism and this little 3 out of 4 observation. Okay. It brings up a kind of interesting thing, though, that I don't think had been noticed before. If you there are bimodule projections of norm other than 1, but what this says is if you look at the set of possible norms of bimodule projections, there's a gap. So let's let maybe N be the set of P such that P and B of L infinity is a projection. And the question is, what can you say about N? I mean, ideally, you'd like to exactly describe what the set N is. But see, this already tells us a little bit about N. It tells us we know 1 is in N. We know that 2 over square root 3 is in N. but we know there's nothing in between. Some work of Choi shows that if you look at the number 2, it's a limit point from a sequence coming up from below. So we know there's a sequence going like that up to that point. It's also easy to show that n's multiplicative, that if you have two numbers which are the norms of ranges of projections, then their product is the norm of a range of a projection. That uses just a simple tensor product idea. So it's a multiplicative subset of the positive reals. But beyond that, nobody seems to know anything. For example, is it discrete? Does it contain an interval? Is it a countable set? Is it an uncountable set? None of that seems to be known. It's clearly closed under the taking of increasing limits, but I don't know if it's closed under decreasing limits, or if you ever have any decreasing limits. So there's very little known about the structure of this set. But this is the first time that I've anyone's noticed, I think, that there are gaps in it. And it can't, it's not a just a whole continuum from one on. You know, for ordinary projections, they can be any norm bigger than or equal to 1. But for bimodular projections, it seems to, it's possibly a discrete series of values. Okay. So, what I'd like to do now is come back to this continuous case. But you see right away there's going to be troubles, because if you have a sure product formalism, it's commutative. So how can you possibly have a sure product formalism? Well, we're going to show that at least for the normal ones, there's a sure product formalism that's strong enough that the same proof for the discrete case works. And what we've been working on lately is we really think this sure product formalism extends. And that's what I want to talk about at the end of the hour. I really think that there really is a sure product formalism which goes beyond just the weak star continuous maps, but involves some delicate questions in measure theory, kind of a geometric measure theory type question to try to extend it. So let me return to the continuous case. Maybe I should leave this. Continuous case. So, for the purposes of the talk, I'm going to assume that D is L infinity. So the first main thing is a result of Hagerup, which says if you have a normal bimodule map, then there exists families of functions fi and gi in L infinity such that the sum of the mod fi squared is finite, sum of the mod gi squared is finite, and what phi has to look like is it's the sum of multiplication by fi x multiplication by gi. This result of Hagerup is true independent of what the massa is. In fact, it doesn't even have to be an abelian thing, and this is true for some for bimodule maps, for normal bimodule maps. Now, if you come back and pair this result up, this looks very different in the little L infinity case. This looks very different from the way we think of things. And we don't think of, we think of little L infinity bimodular maps as sure product maps. We don't think of them as sums of pre- and post-multiplication by diagonal matrices, but it's really the same thing by Hagrup's result, and you can sort of see how to decompose them that way. But what's lost in this is you don't really have the matrix or the function of two variables. Okay? But it certainly suggests that you should have a symbol for phi, and that what that symbol should be this sum, this function of two variables you get by taking the sum. Now, there's lots of problems there, because in general, there's no unique way to write such a sum. And also, these functions are only the L infinity equivalence classes. So in what sense is this symbol unique? So that was the first issue we had to address. And here's the theorem. Let's suppose I have Fi squared, Gi squared, Fi twiddle squared, Gi twiddle squared, all finite, so these are L infinity functions. Suppose I let phi be the operator given this way, and phi twiddle be the operator given by the other set, then the following are equivalent. First off is that T and T twiddle are the same map. Second off is if you look at this function of two variables, let me just denote it gamma phi, that we don't really know it's well defined. Let me just call it k of xy equals the summation fi of x, gi of y. So the second theorem is that k is equal to k twiddle almost everywhere. And the third one, equivalent thing, is a little bit surprising. And that is that they have to be much stronger than equal almost everywhere, but for this class of functions, almost everywhere and this equivalence are the same. And that is that they have to be equal marginally almost everywhere. Now, what marginally almost everywhere means, it means there exists a subset of full measure the measure of whose complement is zero, such that they're actually equal on x cross x. Okay. So you can throw away a null set from the space. So you're doing a null set cross x union x cross a null set. You restrict down to this smaller rectangle. If you view that as your measure space, you're actually equal on that measure space. Okay. What's the difference between almost everywhere and marginally almost everywhere? Well, the most famous example, of course, is to take the characteristic function of the diagonal. It equals zero almost everywhere, but it's not marginally equal to zero. You can't throw away null sets and make it identically zero. Okay. So armed with this theorem, we're able to prove the following. Let P be an NB L infinity. P squared equal P, and P less than square root 2/3, then there exists Xn and Yn disjoint subsets of 0, 1, such that the range of P is the space you get by doing the same sort of corners. You do sum of multiplications by these. And then again, because you have this concrete description of the range, it's very easy to check that M, M star M is contained in M, and that the norm of P is 1. Okay. So you don't really have to worry about this set E for the moment, but I'll show you what it is in just a moment. So the proof is let's let K be the symbol of P. Sorry. So just take any symbol for the moment. Take any way to write it, and that gives me a symbol, right? The symbol's only unique up to marginal almost everywhere. Well, since P composed with P is equal to P, K squared is also a symbol for P. So to make sense of this, you should really think of the symbol of P as not being a concrete function, but being an equivalence class modulo marginal almost everywhere. So what those things tell you is that K squared equals K marginally almost everywhere. And that means you can drop to an X cross X so that K squared equals K on the money on this X cross X. And that means that K is the characteristic function of a set. Because everything inside is Borel, E will be a Borel set. And now the proof is identical to the other proof. You use the fact that the norm is strictly less than 2/3 to prove that this set E, this concrete set E, has the 3 out of 4 property. Once you know it has the 3 of 4 property by the little combinatorial property, by the little combinatorial lemma, you know it's a union of rectangles, possibly an uncountable union of rectangles, but then you have to use the Borelness to get an countable union of rectangles. Okay. So there's a little fussing. The hard part is showing that it's a countable union of rectangles. That uses a little bit. But once you have its countable union of rectangles, it's identical to the scalar proof. So what makes it look so much like the discrete proof is that you have this functional calculus, this theorem.
Yeah. Oh, right here. It's only strong. Yeah. Because if you think about what this is saying, it's saying if you look at the row of the multiplication by F, that it's bounded. But it doesn't say that the tails of the row have to go to zero in norm. So it's just that you have this row operator which is bounded, and so you can multiply and you'll get strong convergence. So, yeah, these sums here only converge in the strong operator topology. Best you can say. Okay. Let me try to formalize what this symbol map says a little bit more. Wanted to save some of this stuff. Let me go back to the middle board. Here's sort of what I think of the symbol calculus. What it's really saying is it's saying that that there exists a map gamma which goes from NB L infinity into the Borel functions on 0, 1 cross 0, 1 mod sets of mod marginally almost everywhere, which is a homomorphism. And so if you start with a projection, the symbol of a projection has to be a function which is equal to its own square. And that's basically how we got it. It had to be the characteristic function of a set. Okay. So you can say a little bit more about this, but what I'd like to do and what I conjecture is the following. So down inside here, we've got the normal, and we have this homomorphism into this algebra, which is our symbol map. And this sets inside all the bounded maps. And what I conjecture is that there exists a unique extension to this, gamma tilde, which is also a homomorphism. And of course, because this algebra is abelian, the kernel of gamma tilde has to at least contain the commutator. But see, the commutator isn't all the singular stuff, it's just some singular stuff. And so the conjecture is that you can do this so that the kernel is exactly the commutator. And trying to do this is what I call trying to build the extended symbol calculus. So what would you expect? I mean, what should this symbol calculus look like? What would you want to happen here? Well, first off, so all I'm going to do is try to give you some suggestive information that maybe this isn't totally Looney Tunes to have such a thing. Okay. Well, first off, if you look at the
suppose I look at two different projections from L2 onto the diagonal. Okay.
These are things that we know live in here. They're singular, but they can't be represented as commutators. At least I told you that was a fact earlier. So what you'd expect is that you should get that the symbol of these is just the characteristic function of the diagonal. You know, this is a measure zero set, which is not marginally zero. So symbols should allow they should include characteristic functions of sets of measure zero, at least some sets of measure zero. And now if this is going to be true, then you would need that any time you take two projections onto the diagonal, the difference is in the commutator space. And at least this much is true. So projections onto the diagonal, although they're not unique, they are unique as cosets of the commutator space. So they could have a symbol. The other piece of suggestive information comes from looking at how the symbol behaves when it acts on operators. So what I mean by this, suppose I take T sub gamma to be an ordinary integral operator, and you apply phi to T sub gamma, then you can see what that does in terms of the symbol. It's the integral operator whose symbol is k times phi. Now, this isn't going to be very good for the singular operators, because the singulars are exactly the things that annihilate the compacts. So you're not going to be able to see them there. But this does suggest if a singular thing is going to have a symbol, then I need this operator to be the zero operator. And the only way that can happen is if this is a function of measure zero, I mean, which is zero almost everywhere, which suggests that, again, that symbols of singular things should live only on sets of measure zero in the product space. Okay. The other interesting thing comes from looking at composition operators. Again, if you have a phi, which is normal, and you do phi to a composition operator, then what you find is that it's multiplication by H times the composition operator. So for all normals ones, composition operators behave like sort of like eigenvectors. And why do I say eigenvectors? Well, remember, in some sense, since we're dealing with big L infinity bimodule maps,
big L infinity functions are our underlying ring. So this is multiplication by an element of the ring times that. And what's more interesting is what H has to be. It's the symbol with X plugged in. So that gives you some idea of how to try to extend this symbol calculus. And at least the first part of it works. So let me state a proposition. Suppose I just have a bounded L infinity bimodule map, not necessarily weak star continuous, and a composition operator. I don't want to have to write down all the things, but let me say with a nice symbol. I can't prove this for the most general symbols, but I can for nice ones. Then there exists an L infinity function H such that phi applied to the composition operator is multiplication by H times the composition operator. So this suggests the way that you should be able to construct the symbol for this map. It's because every time you take a psi and you apply the map to it, it has to be multiplication by some function times psi. But what that function should be the symbol with x psi of x plugged in. So here's the measure theory problem that I can't solve. So what I know, I've got this unknown function k. At the moment, I only conjecture it exists, but I hope it's out there. And what I can do is I can tell what k is restricted to the graph of every nice function. So I'm trying to hear k by looking at what it does to graphs. Which functions can I recognize that way? So among the test questions, suppose I have a function k, and for every graph, the function I get here is equal to 0 almost everywhere. So I can't hear it at all. Does the function k have to be marginally 0? If it's not marginally 0, like, for example, the diagonal you hear by taking the psi of x to be x, and then you get a function which is equal to 1 everywhere. So most functions I've looked at and most things that we can construct bimodular projections onto, those kinds of sets, we can hear all those sets. But we can't prove that, we can't solve this sort of measure theory mess. So that's kind of where we're stuck at the moment, and I see my time's up anyways. Thank you.